Latino Stories, Historias Latinas, es un podcast que nace del proyecto de narrativas orales de latinos en Ohio, Oral Narratives of Latinos in Ohio, con entrevistas en español, inglés, and Spanglish.
Welcome to Latino Stories. I'm Elena Fowlis. My guest today is Nolan Cabrera. Dr. Nolan Cabrera is an award-winning scholar and nationally recognized expert in the areas of racism, anti-racism on college campuses, whiteness, and ethnic studies. He's currently a professor in the Center for the Study of Higher Education at the University of Arizona and was the only academic featured in the MTV documentary, White People. Bienvenido a este episodio, Nolan.
Thank you so much for the invitation. Appreciate you having me.
Nolan, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Did you grow up there in Arizona?
No, I'm actually from McMinnville, Oregon. So I spent the first 18 years of my life there. Then I've been doing this West Coast, Southeast, Southwest tour because I went from there to the Bay Area to do my undergraduate studies. It is in comparative studies in race and ethnicity at Stanford University, then became the director of a Boys and Girls Club on school site right after graduation. We did that for about 2.5-3 years. And then after that, pursued my graduate studies at UCLA in higher education organizational change, and then somehow made my way out to Arizona, where it just so happened that moving out to Arizona coincided with a lot of the very regressive policies of the 2010s, banning of Mexican American studies in Tucson, the very draconian anti-immigrant laws that were happening at the time. It was kind of a trial by fire coming into that. But it makes me very aware of the different playbooks that are happening right now for different, area studies bannings and that we see across the country, because the playbook is very, very similar, even though it's a decade and a half apart.
Right. I just reminded me, where on Twitter, what is your location? What do you put there?
Yes. the cool thing was that for it being the belly of the beast and all eyes on Arizona, in the early 2010s, the beautiful resistance that I was able to see and experience on a regular basis was incredible. Because, I mean, even being involved in the case around the banning of Mexican American studies and challenging the constitutionality of it, we're a ragtag group of folks challenging a state law. Mm-hmm. And after 7 years of litigation, we won. Like, that's, I know I'm tooting our own horn, but that's like that's a lot given the resources that a state can throw at something like that. It's incredible to see, and then it's also incredible to see just on a local level how, amidst so much inhumanity, you can see some of the greatest examples of humanity. Mm-hmm. Just people giving so much of themselves, putting themselves at risk so that other people can survive, other people can thrive in these really, really trying circumstances. It's incredible to see. I would just like to be able to see it, greatest expressions of humanity without all the dehumanizing policies in the process.
Absolutely.
Because, we literally just validated the 1864 law that banned all abortions under all circumstances. That's a law that literally was passed before Arizona was a state, before women had the right to vote, before the Civil War had ended. And yet that's the law of the land now in Arizona. I'm just like, wow, I don't have to be creative. Just poke my head out the window and see all the stuff that's going on.
Right. In many ways, I think we're going backwards, right? We're not moving. Make a quick comment about that. Like, I moved to Texas recently, almost 2 years, and people were, saying, "You're going to Texas?" because of the politics, right? But I'm going to San Antonio, and San Antonio is a different type of Texas, right? There is a lot of activism and really in the bigger cities, right? Houston, Dallas, Austin, and San Antonio, for sure. There's a history of civil rights activism, that all types of activism here. So I said, I think I'm in good company, you know, where I'm going. Not to say that what happens at state level doesn't affect me or can't affect me, but I do feel like there's a lot of energy to push back. Right? So there's that. That's one, you know, advantage, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yes, Nolan, your book titles are very provoking. White Guys on Campus, Racism, White Immunity, and the Myth of Post-Racial Higher Education. And then your latest one, Whiteness and the Ivory Tower. Why don't we notice the white students sitting together in the quad? And this is particularly, you know, important and a great source of discussion in a time where currently, right, we're experiencing a lot of overt expressions of white supremacists and then also white fragility, right? And in a way that is not just in your face, right? It's very much unapologetically, right? That we're seeing this. How are you able to navigate today's environment in a way that is conducive to learning and dismantling stereotypes and myths about communities of color in our campuses?
There's a couple of things. Well, are you asking me more of my methodology or kind of what keeps me going? Because those are kind of two different areas.
You pick.
All right. Well, I mean, in terms of the method, is that I think it's important to be able to accurately name social problems as they arise. And so, you know, the motivation behind the, you know, the secondary title of my second book, Why Don't We Notice the White Kid Sitting Alone in the Quad? First of all, it was a riff on Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum's classic text, Why Are the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? But it begs an empirical question juxtaposed against the sort of popular discourse around race on campus, because it's so predictable that, you know, every few months, there's another attack on higher ed, specifically saying, why are all of it fill in the blank racial ethnic minority group? Why are they segregating? Mm-hmm. Why is there, you know, why is there a black grad? Why is there a Chicano student center? Why is it, you know, why, how would it, what would it look like if we had a white student union? And the problem is that when it comes to whiteness, it's such a normal method of existing. Mm-hmm. And relatively unmarked, that when white kids do it, it's framed as happenstance, as opposed to something that's structured, both in terms of personal preference as well as the ability to over exclude. And so that's why we don't notice. And what's interesting is part of that book was identifying the empirical literature on it. And it keeps coming up over and over and over again that the number one most group on college campuses who have the highest level of segregated friendship groups tend to be white people in general and white men in particular. And those get very much exacerbated in the housed Greek system, as well as in, I know I'm surprised about this, but it seems somewhat intuitive, in religious-based organizations. Mm-hmm. And that goes back to James Baldwin's polemic but prophetic quote about that the most segregated time in American society is high noon on Sunday. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, so part of this is just sort of popular education, trying to debunk myths, but, you know, having a data-based and scholarly basis to make that assessment, because the disconnect between what's real and what people are talking about is so massive. Mm-hmm. And that's really what's troubling about being in a quote-unquote post-truth era, is that there's so much doubt just around what is real and what is not. And people dig in so much to their own perceptions of reality. They don't think that maybe my reality isn't, you know, feeding me that accurately. And so, like, if you ask white folk, you know, what percentage of scholarships are restricted by race. I mean, usual numbers will be, you know, 30, 40, 50%. When in fact, if I remember correctly, I'm not going to remember this off the top of my head, but it was like, you know, 1/10, 1% of them are. And then if you really include just general financial aid and other kinds of merit-based scholarships, it drops so much that it's not even, but you're paying so much attention to it.
Right.
And it poses literally no threat to your well-being, but you get really bent out of shape about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the struggling part about it because, one of the things though that I really do appreciate right now, number one is that the very aggressive backlash that we're receiving right now, or what some scholars have referred to as a white lash, it's a predictable outcome that happens after we've won something. So there was a predictable white lash when. Right after the civil rights movement, there was a predictable white lash, which, you know, was basically Reconstruction. There's a predictable white lash when, you know, we've won affirmative action cases at the Supreme Court. There's a predictable backlash. It's a very, very, very common occurrence. And so I try to reframe this as sort of disruptions of whiteness, and actually a statement that we have won. We're actually worth fighting at this point. Mm-hmm. And I also have to remember, though, that no matter how bad things get right now, no matter how tough they are, if we look historically, the way that our ancestors struggled in even more dire circumstances, it would actually be a very logical approach to not struggle, just to say, "Well, this is the way things are. I'm going to throw my hands and that's it." They didn't. They fought so that I could be here. And so I owe it as the legacy of the memory to say, yeah, things are tough right now. And they're probably only going to get tougher for the foreseeable future. And folks have fought harder under more dire circumstances. And not to say one oppression is better or worse than the other, but in order for me to honor their legacy, I don't have the luxury of giving up. It's not even on the table. It has to be there as a component of praxis. And then that also gives me hope in the process, because sometimes it's easy to fall into hopelessness. And that generation and the previous generations never lost hope. Mm-hmm. So it would be disrespectful to their memory if I did myself.
Right. I was thinking, and I was talking to students, right, about what do we do when you have places disappearing, right, in our institutions where they were before places of belonging for students. Or, you know, we can do two things. So I guess we can still like fight back, advocate, you know, bring attention to it. But we can also just be with the people, right? Like sit down with them, create a different kind of home and a different kind of space for them to feel safe. So sometimes we don't win big, but that doesn't mean that we can't do small things to continue to create, you know, to honor those people that are perhaps feeling even more vulnerable, right? When they're not places for them to be.
Well, I mean, but what you're highlighting right there was also the fact that these places were never permanent. They only came out of a struggle. And it's important for us to remember that historically, that, you know, it's not just that, you know, this Chicano center just was here.
Right.
It was that people fought for it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And it wasn't that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And if we lose it now, it's, you know, it's that old paradigm of the last one's in, first one's out. But it's also one of those things that's a good reminder that we can't be complacent with it. And that's one of the things that it's easy to do, is to just accept as normal. Oh yeah, you know, they built a physics department. They built a Chicano Studies Center. It's like, no. Yes, they built the physics department. And there was probably some sort of like a hunger strike that led to the Chicano Studies Department, you know? And if we don't understand that legacy,
which didn't happen for the physics building, right?
Exactly. I'm a higher ed scholar, and I actually don't know a single sit-in that led to the creation of a physics department.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And yeah, right. Those are really good reminders. I like what you said of not being complacent, right? Not say, okay, this is it. We have it here, right? And we do with students, I also talk about where these places, right, of belonging are. Are they an afterthought, right? If they, you know, however they happen to appear on a campus, maybe because, you know, there was this push, you know, for student, like students or faculty for that space, is usually not in the center, right, of the university. Yeah. And that also is very telling of where the university is putting the value, right, of those centers and
exactly
next, you know, ethnic groups, women's centers, where are they? Yeah, they're usually at least the ones that I know about in the basement.
on the periphery.
If we stay complacent, something can come and remove it from us. Right. So. Mm-hmm. So how do we keep moving, keep pressing on so those things are not, they don't disappear? And this is particularly important, right, in places like here in Texas, Florida, Utah. I'm not sure where the DEI policies are in Arizona, but it makes it really difficult, not only because you're seeing those places or those people. I mean, UT Austin just fired, let go.
Laid off. Yep, 60, exactly.
Yeah, 60 people that serve in, you know, some sort of capacity in those offices. Uh-huh. And so that the removal or the disappearance of those centers or people, staff, right, really makes it hard to have conversations about, you know, the importance of having those places, right? And so my question to you is, so what do you think of this? But also, how can we, as faculty, staff, continue to have these conversations, even though we don't have a center, right? Or we don't have the people. And I mean, I have different opinions about DEI centers to begin with, right? Where it's not the work of one person or a small group, it's the work of the whole institution. But so anyway, I wanted to ask this question.
Yeah, I think when it comes to DEI, it number one, it shows kind of the fallacy of only focusing on DEI, because when you only allow DEI DEI is so. In such a contrast to the popular rhetoric, DEI is not a radical realignment, redistribute. You know, the way that you hear it, it's like, you know, Marxist revolutionaries are taking over our universities and they're going, you know, they're going to teach you how to hate white people and take all the resources out of real studies and go into community organizing. And it's like the fact that we were so timid and tepid with DEI to start off with allowed for this to happen, because that's sort of what was seen as kind of the end point, the most radical end point. And that gets eroded very quickly. You know, you were asking, how do we defend, you know, our cultural centers? Well, we defend them by not saying, okay, I'm defending this cultural center turf. It's saying, no, we need to be expanding. We need to be going bigger. We need to incorporate it more. You know, so in many respects, it wasn't necessarily a failure of DEI. It was that we didn't do enough DEI. It wasn't that it wasn't deeply embedded enough, mm-hmm. into the institutions themselves. Now, having said that, you know, we can still have a lot of really good, meaningful work around this, even if it's not institutionally sanctioned. I think that there's kind of in some areas, and again, it depends on how it's structured. In some areas, a DEI office can actually lead to complacency inadvertently, because it becomes that idea of, oh, that's their job over there. My job is, you know, to do this work. And so there is a possibility that this can open up more meaningful, deep conversations around that in terms of distributing the workload and making it everybody's responsibility to continue doing the DEI work. But at the end of the day, it's one of those ones that it needs to be a very intentionally concerted effort. And like I said, we can't continue to be complacent with DEI. Like, there's this constant, we have this really bad way in higher ed of kind of being like, okay, we did our DEI training. Are we done? Okay, we did, you know, are we right. basically, and it's one of those things that it's like, no, we will be done when white supremacy is done. Mm-hmm. That's not going to happen in our lives. So it has to be fundamental and foundation to what it is that we do. And it's so critically important to understand it as a process engaged as opposed to an end met. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, it require, I think the other thing that it's going to require us to do in terms of strategy and tactic is understand how much on the defensive that we have been regarding DEI. Don't think of us as critical race theory. Don't think about us as this, don't think about us as that. When in fact, we've never put those who are attacking on the defensive. And we know their playbook. Heck, Chris Ruffo literally just laid out his playbook I believe it was an article in Politico, where he literally said, here's the target that I find, here's how you do it, you know? And so it doesn't matter whether it's critical race theory or Dr. Gay at Harvard or, you know, whatever his next one is. I know I heard briefly he has another target on the new head of NPR. And so each one of these is a new target. It's the exact same playbook. But why are we always spending time on the defensive? I've given more interviews than I can think about, or than I can count regarding bannings of critical race theory. Mm-hmm. And the very first question without fail is almost always, so could you just set the record straight? What exactly is critical race theory? As if that's actually why we're having the conversation in the first place. Mm-hmm. These are manufactured crises. They're the old school, it's a solution in search of a problem. And so then you have the manufactured problem. And the more that we buy into it, the more that we buy into their playbook. Mm-hmm. And right now it has to be putting them on the defensive, where you're directly saying, no, I am not, I'm not playing this game with you. You're saying that we need to ban critical race theory. I don't have to defend critical race theory because all I have to do is say banning stuff is censorship, and that's just wrong. Mm-hmm. That's antithetical, right? That's antithetic. You claim to be the freedom party, yet you're restricting people's freedoms left, right, and center. You know, and again, you see how you flip the script on by not buying into their framing of the situation. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really what we need to be able to do with this DEI stuff. But it's really uncomfortable because it requires us to fight in these cultural wars. And a lot of us aren't trained to do that. Or I shouldn't say that. We're taught that we're not trained to do that. We have been trained to do it on the playgrounds, but we forget that because for all of the stuff about, I want to bring my authentic self into higher ed, we forget some foundational lessons from the playground that we just kind of check at the door. The way that we do this right now, it would be like if you're playing the dozens with your friend and he's like, well, your mom is so fat. And then I say, instead of coming back, you know, it's the defensive posturing. It'd be as absurd as I was like, well, look, she has a weight problem and she's pre-diabetic, but she has a thyroid problem. And right. And it's like, no, my job on the playground is to go back and be like, well, your mama. So exactly. And we don't do that because it's right. One of these things that we have. And I'm not saying we do this with each other in higher education spaces, but rather when we're engaging the popular discourse, we have to ask the question, are there honest questions being asked? Is this a real crisis or a manufactured crisis? Mm-hmm. Right. And it gets really complicated right now because, for example, there's a massive rise in anti-Semitism on campuses, and there's a massive rise of Islamophobia on campuses. Unfortunately, when you start having this conversation and you have very real risks to these students' well-beings on campuses, a lot of times when the question is being asked, there's kind of a subtext to it. It's kind of like, you know, that I really don't care. I mean, the whole congressional hearings with Dr. Gay, they didn't care about anti-Semitism. They don't care about Jewish students, period. They wanted to figure out a way to creatively shame a Black president and to try to get her and the liberal woke institutions on the defensive. So you have a very real problem, but a dishonest question. And whenever you have a dishonest question, that's when we got to go back to our playground training, where it's like, no, because, it's tough to discern, but that's what we have to do right now.
And a lot of times those questions, they're looking for also what side are you on, right? That's what they're trying to like get you to agree to or to say.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that's the beautiful thing is that if we're thinking on our toes the way that you are, it gets you in that mindset of what are you really asking here? Mm-hmm. Wait, are you pro-Palestinian? Are you pro-Israel?
Okay. Right.
Actually, I'm pro-human life. Mm-hmm. So any life that is lost, any innocent life that is lost in this war, in this attack, in this massive human displacement, in this genocide, any human life that is lost is precious and is not considered disposable. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's the side. And again, I immediately flip the script. I'm on the side of humanity.
Right.
You know, and so you got to, but again, it requires us to think on our toes and be able to go, oh no, I don't accept the parameters that you put forth. I'm going to choose that. And I want to stick to my principles and what I believe and the greater advancement of humanity in the process.
Right. I mean, and I mean, we can have conversations about this also about immigration, right. And undocumented immigrants. And I think about the same, right. Whether pro or against, I'm like, well, can we just be pro human dignity, right? And the lives of people crossing the border instead of some political, you know, agenda that most people carry with them. So yeah, absolutely. So I have to remember that my playground running. And I remember my brothers always saying, no te dejes, like defend yourself always, right?
Exactly. And it's a beautiful thing. But again, it's funny that you brought up the border, because when we only think of these simplistic binaries, we end up with really stupid and bad policies that don't really do anything about it. Mm-hmm. Because right now it's like build the wall or put a lot more border patrol troops on there. Oh, wait, Republicans and Democrats can't agree. And it's like, both of those solutions were stupid.
Right.
They're wastes of money and profoundly misunderstand the realities on the border. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was one time I remember when I first moved down here, I went with some colleagues to a health, it's like a little center on the border, right? Mm-hmm. That will give people advice about basically how to survive in the Sonoran Desert.
Okay.
When you're doing this 4-day walk and you're just, you know, when you go there, like leading up to that, there's just signs everywhere that say, go back, don't risk your life. It's not worth it. You know, which by the way, is a reality that no US politician actually acknowledges. They're always like, well, Mexico's complicit. Everything there keeps saying, like, look, I know y'all are going to, you're risking your lives because we have huge numbers of deaths on the U.S.-Mexico border for the precise reason that people don't go through the urban centers anymore, because that's where it's filtered into the deserts. As we were going through this organization, they said, you know, and they have sort of a structured messaging. First message, just, it's so dangerous. Go back. Oh, by the way, in Arizona, we have a bomb range. If you go west instead of east, there's literally like in a place where they do bomb testing. So on top of everything. It's intense. One of the people in my group asked the humanitarian aid workers there, okay, you have all this messaging, everything. How you've been doing this for 10 years. How many people have turned back? It's just, oh, none. They never do. And it shows just how, as we've had all these neoliberal reforms throughout Latin America, how many people get left behind. And then when we take their land in the process, because that's also part of neoliberal reforms, that they don't have anywhere else to go. An economy goes into recession. It's a simple thing. My family is going to die, or I'm going to try to go north. It's not like this simple, you know, this simple, oh yeah, cool, I'm just going to cross the border. People think that's so easy.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get an infected blister in your foot walking for 4 days. That can literally, something that minor can lead to your death if you're not careful.
Right.
And these are the people who are crossing the border. And then, you know, but the rhetoric's like, no, they're bringing their rapists and their drug dealers and a bunch of bad hombres. And it's like, yeah, and it's easy to play with the racist American political imagination when people fundamentally don't know what the reality is.
Right.
And so when people don't know what the reality is and they're afraid of it, you just have this open box and you just fill in, you define it yourself. And that's how political opportunism has been going. And the really sad thing is the Biden administration was trying to say, oh, the Republicans are tough on the border. I'm going to be even tougher. And it's like, that doesn't do anything. It's good political posturing, and it doesn't do anything. And it actually means people are going to die in the process.
Yeah, I was, I had a conversation with a lawyer that focuses on immigration, and he says, you know, a lot of the judges that write this bills or laws, you know, things until have never been at the border.
Exactly.
They have zero idea of life on the border, right? And what it is, like he grew up on the border. I grew up on the border too. And what it means to us, right? What the day to day is, what it means to like just cross and, you know, to celebrate birthdays, to see family members, friends, and what they imagine, what people that have never been in these places imagine those crossing or the state of, you know, this U.S. border. Your work centers on how white-centric spaces, which we could say most spaces in higher ed, are really places that create or reproduce harmful narratives and environments for BIPOC students. You know, despite all of this and the work that you've done, and what kind of changes have you seen in higher education as a result, perhaps, of the work that you're doing? Because your books, right, are sort of dispelling myths, right, about what people think about affirmative action or I don't know, centers, etc.
Well, first of all, I can't speak to the impact of my books, so I'll leave that to other folks. But there's always there's a sociologist named Melanie Bush. She always talks about you always have to be able to look for the cracks in the walls of whiteness and be able to find those areas where there is possibility. And I kind of need to be clear about a couple of things. You know, number one, I will always offer opportunities for learning and growth and development. And at the same time, my job is not to rehabilitate racist white people. Like that's, you know, I don't get paid enough to do that. But I think one of the things that we frequently forget is there's a frequent confusion over activism, advocacy, and governance. And what I mean by that is that, you know, we think, oh, well, you know, folks come through higher ed, they should have a certain set of skills, and, you know, we want to give them these opportunities, but not everyone is going to take advantage of them. So there's structured opportunities for intergroup dialogue where people can really grow and learn about themselves and learn about, you know, structural racism, patriarchy, all these different things, and how they fit into these larger systems of oppression. And some people don't take advantage of it. But it's the same way as some folks, you know, take a hardcore, you know, mathematics curriculum. And some people are like, I took college algebra and I'm good. I don't need any more. I'm good to go. And so it's important to structure the opportunities and to think about those. But the goal is not to, you know, at the end of the year, have every single person, you know, every single incoming student be, you know, racially aware and woke and all this stuff. And it's not even possible. And it's not a desirable outcome. It's allowing people opportunities to grow and be really racially conscious in the process. And part of the reason why I talk about it like as activism, advocacy, and governance is we all too often have think about advocacy and activism as the way that we talk about getting elected. Like you have to be popular, get 50.1%, and then things change at the institution or things change in society. Yeah. When in fact, the big lesson from the civil rights movement was that a small concerted group of people were really able to change, disrupt, and transform fundamentally a lot of structures of society, opening up avenues for ethnic studies, intentional college outreach, a lot of different kinds of structures that we, the cultural campus, cultural centers. And it didn't take getting a plurality to say, hey, we give thumbs up. It was the ability to advocate and sometimes engage in activism and social and civil disobedience that got those things in place. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of the day, I will give anybody an opportunity to learn with me. And I love that as a thing. But I'm also the thing that drives me nuts with my work is that, and I hear this all the time, well, you didn't convince me. And it's like, that's not my job to convince you of a reality. You want to know what I think. And if you choose not to see it that way, that's your prerogative. But it's always kind of this, but you're an educator, you should try to convince me. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, when it comes to things like racial studies, it's one of the few areas that people act like that. Like, it would be absurd to be in your basic biology class where they're talking about, okay, foundationally, here's how evolution happens, and this is where Darwin went down to the Galapagos, all these things. You didn't convince me evolution's real. Well, I mean, I'm sure there's someone there, but the amount in mass that we had, because everybody experiences race in some way, but everyone seems to be an expert in it. Mm. And it's like, this is the, you know, here's where I come from academically. Here's the evidence that I have, you know, and also the thing is that I'm not here to indoctrinate anybody. I'm here to just offer, this is my informed opinion about what this looks like. If you're going to offer an informed opinion, please make sure you have some evidence. But I don't want you to think exactly like me. But that phrase, you didn't convince me, is so obnoxious because it also is intellectually lazy. It doesn't require you to actually do something or build anything. It's like, you know, it's that stupid meme where the guy's sitting there out in a quad has his table out and says, something is real. Change my mind, you know.
And it's like
you're not going to change each other's minds. It's supposed to be an exchange of ideas and perspectives that are well informed on issues, and it's supposed to elevate the discourse in that way. And so for me, it's about having these ideas out there. But really, you know, at the end of the day, part of it is discursive. That all too often when we say we have a racial issue on campus, it means that, you know, there was an ethnic theme party where a bunch of white fraternity guys were wearing sombreros and did South of the Border. Someone called a black kid the N-word on campus. You know, people are wearing tribal headdress, but it's always on the minoritized group. It's always, we have a problem with our black students, or our brown students. And it's like, no, part of what I want to do is say, like, look, there's a cause and effect relationship here. If there's a marginalized group, you have a privileged group. If you have a harmed group, you have a group doing the harming. And let's think about it holistically. And if we're being honest about it, we have to be honest about the harm, unintentionally, but still real, how a lot of white men do cause harm without really realizing it. And at the very least, acknowledging that and starting from that perspective is a really important point, because otherwise what ends up happening is not only do BIPOC students end up being the target of racial harassment, but then they are responsible for trying to fix the problem at the same time. And that becomes sort of a double whammy. It's like, administration, well, tell us what we should do. It's like, you're the $300,000 a year administrator. You figure it out. Right. You know, I did love it when there was an issue with indigenous students being targeted on campus. Two of them were consistently asked by the presidential cabinet, how do we do this? 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 And then they started saying, well, would you, like, we're giving you a lot of time and energy, and like, we're basically unpaid consultants. Could you make us paid consultants? And said, oh, we don't have money for that. So they made up a bill that said, these are our hours, and submitted it. And of course they'd never get paid. It went viral on Instagram, because it's that beautiful thing. It's like, hey, here you go. You have your lawyers on retainer. You have all of your accountants, business managers on retainer. You value those components. You say you value DEI. you're asking for our expertise. Mm-hmm. You're demanding hours and hours and hours because of our collective expertise. If you really value it, then put your money where your mouth is.
Right. Absolutely. Or, you know, just like give the land back.
Oh, just did that. Yes. Oh my goodness. That was horrible. Right when that was so random tangent, but this is really funny. So right when land acknowledgements were becoming popular, mm-hmm. the provost at the U of A was a white South African. And let's just say it's really, really tough. He struggled with DEI issues for obvious reasons. And it was awesome because we were at an event and he tried to give his first land acknowledgement. And he says, and we'd like to acknowledge the Tonawatam and Pascoyaki peoples who's let us borrow their land. And we're like, oh, no.
No.
Exactly. Yes.
Absolutely. Nolan, so you have a new book it's called Whiteness and the Ivory Tower. Why don't we notice the white students sitting together in the quad? Can you talk to us a little bit about this?
Sure. So I wanted to take multiple issues in higher education and really ask the question, what would it look like? Well, how is whiteness? Well, it's two separate questions. One is, how is whiteness manifest in this area? And then number two is, what would it look like if we divested from whiteness, if we didn't buy into the logics of whiteness in these spaces? But it gets really complicated because the issues are not cut and dry. So I ask, what would something like academic freedom look like? Because we know that under the guise of academic freedom, a lot of academics have done some massive harm to BIPOC communities, to the point that critical theorists for a while just gave up on quantitative inquiry, saying it only does harm. I think that's an overstatement. And a lot of critical race theorists are coming back and trying to rehabilitate quantitative analyses. But the point being that, you know, that idea of the divorced social scientist from what they're looking at, you know, objectively through a microscope, phenomenon X, Y, and Z, it undermines what we know about our own humanity, but also does a lot of harm in the process. So what would it look like if we made academia work for as opposed to against BIPOC communities? You know, the issue of campus-based segregation, but issues of campus leadership and even organizational structure, you know, because I really liked the way that Victor Ray argued around our campuses, basically organizations being racialized. And one of the core ways that he looks at it is a key way of identifying where whiteness shows up is you have the formal rules. And when do you see that those rules get broken? So a simple example at the university that I'm at is that it's always data-driven decision-making. We need data-driven decision-making. We want to invest in the, I can hear your eye roll.
Yes.
We want to invest in high impact practices. And the thing is, on the surface, I actually agree with that. Like, you know, I want to make sure that the services that our BIPOC students are receiving are quality and are actually really good and supporting their needs, but the devil's always in the details. And so there was a really interesting analysis that came out where somebody ran a really tight little regression model looking at all of the academic support units, so all the different tutoring centers and, you know, all that stuff, and then started looking at outcomes of interest, persistence, and grade point average, and things like that. And what was fascinating was that, because I thought that a lot of these, you know, especially as they come to scale, they're just not going to be effective. My goodness, all the ones supporting minoritized students were statistically significant and positive in their results. I was like, that's interesting. But the one that had a non-significant but negative relationship was the pay for play that largely served white and upper middle class students on campus. And the thing is, it's data-driven decisions. We shouldn't be supporting them. But now the administration starts dancing around and saying, well, They're a massive revenue generator. It's like, yeah, they do bring in revenue, but we don't actually ask what is it costing us, because they're getting all the space for free. We're subsidizing their outreach. We advertise for them constantly. So we don't actually take account of how much we're spending on them. We just keep saying this is a net gain off of it. And it's shown to be ineffective, which means, again, we have our ethos. Here's where the rules got broken. Here's an example of how whiteness comes in. So it's different areas like that that I'm trying to explore and really trying to ask the core question, to really ask us to reimagine higher education. Because I get the inclination of some folks that it's like higher ed has just been so harmful and so toxic to our peoples for so long that why are we defending it in any way? And I'm not really defending higher education. I'm defending the potential of higher education to really be able to do some good informing of public policy, educational opportunities, you know, workforce development, but doing it in ways that really support our communities in the process. You know, because, you know, it's done a great deal tangible support for upper class white communities. Why not let this opportunity, why not let this incredible structure work for our people for a little bit? And that's really the basis of the book. That's really what I want to get at, you know, because, you know, and but again, it's really, really complicated, because the same institutions that are antagonistic to, say, knowledge bases that come out of our communities also gave, through really intentional antagonism over many years, that's how critical race theory was developed, you know. And so while critical race theorists are critical of academic freedom and how it has been used to harm our communities, they're also leveraging it to validate, you know, to support the academic pursuit of our own knowledge bases. And it's not clean and it's really messy. You know, I kind of the way I describe it in the book is that it's kind of like we're asked to defend an institution that's historically been antagonistic to our communities, a kind of academic unrequited love. But, and this is me being a smart aleck, but as Pat Benatar reminds us, love is a battlefield.
Yeah, that's right. I'm looking forward to reading it, because I think about, I'm at an HSI, right? A Hispanic serving institution. And I invite my students to think about how is it serving our community? How is it serving, you know, we have over 75% of students who identify as Latino Hispanic. Do we see ourselves getting what we need, what we want? Is it culturally relevant? Is it? And my department has been really good about, like, really thinking about how are we best supporting our students, and like it's starting from the curriculum and the services that we can provide for our students. But really, in particular, right, because as an HSI, in my view, and this is the first time I teach at an HSI, we have an obligation, right? I mean, exactly. I was previously at a land grant university, and I thought the same thing. Like, we have an obligation to our community, right? To the people that the university serves. And there is a disconnect, you know, there is.
Yes, it totally is.
Here specifically, I think I'm very passionate about, like, how do we make sure that in everything that we're doing and the programs we're developing and the policies, we are really doing what we need to do for the population that we serve inside the institution and also outside, because this university in particular was built on the south side of San Antonio, which is a predominantly Latinx community, historically underserved. You know, we are just now building a hospital. It has been like a medical hospital desert in this area. So how do we make sure that we are doing everything we can so that our people thrive, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it gets back to the way that Gina Garcia conceives of the concept of serving, that, you know, that a lot of times HSIs are only Hispanic enrolling, but not Hispanic serving, and really tending to those needs. Because by being Hispanic serving, we actually have to grapple with the fact that most of these institutions that have evolved into being brown, we're not set up with that as the intention.
Right.
And so you have a whole new group of students here, and it's a unique set of needs. And how do you actually meet said needs? And actually, instead of being just enrolling and getting the federal monies to be able to say, hey, we're an HSI, how do you actually serve their needs in that process? And I like that as a difference, because then it also says serving this as a process, something that we're constantly trying to talk about and update in these ones. And it's a tough one, but it also gets to some core issues that, you know, like, look, our students are the subject or the targets of racism constantly. How do we address that? We have to have that as a meaningful issue. And that way, serving this and academics and DEI all kind of merge into one component where you really can't, it's hard to do the academic component if we're not taking care of these other needs through serving this that we're talking about.
Right. Right. But academics, people in higher ed don't always see that, right? They don't always see that connection that we can't really progress if we don't think of it as all connected, right? In order to be successful or to move forward and really serve our students. Nolan, yes. What other projects are you working on?
Okay, this is a fun one. It's not a fun one. It's a heartbreaking one. But I'm in the midst of writing a book about the banning of Mexican-American studies in Tucson, as I alluded to at the beginning, as well as the grassroots and legal resistance to the state law that banned Mexican-American studies and was eventually found to be unconstitutional. And so that is a labor of love, because I was an expert witness in that case and deeply involved in it throughout all of Tucson. And it's a tough one. It's a tough one because a lot of times when we hear civil rights stories, it tends to follow kind of that like Luke Skywalker hero arc, you know, that like, you know, and there was the evil empire, and you know, Luke came up and learned to be a Jedi, and Cesar Chavez fasted, and all of a sudden things changed, and you know, now everything's great. And it's a lot more complicated and nuanced. And you know, what was really heartbreaking in Tucson was not just that Mexican American studies was banned, my role there was to be a statistician, and you don't see educational results like that. As a matter of fact, when they were presented at court, the state only hired one expert witness. It was to debunk my stats. And his core argument was that the stats, he'd thread a really fine needle. He'd be like, I'm not actually saying they're cheating, but the stats are too good to be believed. And it was like, I mean, it drove me nuts. It was like we were back in the movie Stand and Deliver, where the kids get their AP test back, and then they do all well, and then they get accused of cheating because they come from you know, a brown school in East LA. You know, and it was the same thing, you know, like 30 years later. What's beautiful about that, those are children's lives that are touched that in that way, and to have that kind of a curriculum and that kind of pedagogy ripped away from the community, that's painful. And then on top of it, you start seeing some of the infighting that happens when people are trying to do this work, and it is really, really difficult to navigate. And even with that, there's still some important lessons that can be gleaned as people are still trying to navigate so many of these bannings that are occurring in 2023 and 2024. So there's just a lot there. That's the big project that I'm working on right now. And it's been a 7-year labor of love, and we'll see how it keeps developing.
That's great. Looking forward to reading that and to hopefully never having to write something like that here in Texas. Well, thank you so much, Nolan, for this conversation. I look forward to reading more of your work and hopefully having you here in San Antonio one of these days.
Beautiful. Thanks so much for having me, and I appreciate the conversation.